Page 15, side 1, House Committee on Judiciary, Wednesday, February 26th, 1:30 p.m., room 350, Subcommittee 2, Public Hearing and Possible Work Session. House Bill 2306, Repeal Provisions Relating to Action by Guest Passengers.
House Committee on Judiciary will come to order. The clerk will note those members present. Representatives Mason and... I think Mason's still in there. Representative Mason's excused. The first item on our agenda is public hearing on House Bill 2306. William Wiswall.
Do both of these work? Mr. Chairperson and ladies and gentlemen, my name is Bill Wiswall. I'm a practicing plaintiff's attorney in Springfield, Oregon. And to my right is Sharon Hill, a young lady that I represented in Hood River, Oregon several years ago in a guest passenger case. Sharon Hill was the person whose case was taken to the United States Supreme Court about 2 years ago, where the court ultimately refused to grant a writ of certiorari, which thereby effectively affirmed a decision of the Oregon Supreme Court, which had held that the present Oregon guest passenger statute was constitutional. In my practice, which handles as a specialty personal injury litigation, I would say off the cuff that I have at the present time around anywhere from 70 to 90 personal injury cases, of which approximately 20 perhaps or 15 involve a guest passenger situation. In my opinion, based upon my experience in the practice of law and in seeing cases handled and developed, the guest passenger law is a very cruel law, which really has no basis for being in existence at the present time. Historically speaking, a long time ago, the guest passenger statute was enacted to encourage picking up of hitchhikers and at the same time discouraging lawsuits to be brought by hitchhikers against persons who had socially given them a ride in their automobile. It was also enacted, or at least one of the two theories for it, the second being to prevent fraudulent claims being made by passengers against their host insurance company. Unfortunately, those two reasons have been overridden by current legislation and also the social rule for the evolvement of the guest passenger statute as it presently stands now before the court, which is simply a mass of confusion so that the trial judges of this state are completely incompetent, in my opinion, of adequately defining what constitutes gross negligence to the members of a 12-panel jury in deciding the rights and liabilities of the parties before the court. I'll give you a few examples of cases in my office which will be dissolved, so to speak, and effectively ejected from the office because there isn't any claim. I represent the estate of a boy by the name of Rogers, a young man who was killed while a passenger on a motorcycle. The motorcycle was being operated in a direction toward Eugene, Oregon, and was behind a Volkswagen van, and the motorcycle operator decided to pass it. There's issue of fact as to which side he passed on, but it's fairly clear that at the present time, at least from our investigation, that he passed on the left-hand side while the Volkswagen van was in the process of making a signaled left turn into his driveway, so that the van operator was clearly not negligent. The motorcycle operator was clearly negligent, but not grossly so, and therefore, based upon the evidence, we'll have to reject the case from the office. Another case that we have pending in the office there's a case that was involved in the Cottage Grove Reservoir recently where two boats collided. This statute applies to boats equally as well as automobiles. The Coast Guard conducted an investigation. In our boat, the boat in which the persons that I'm involved with were in, or at least one of them, one man was killed and the other was a child who was in a coma with a brain injury for a substantial period of time. The Coast Guard conducted an investigation and they assess 1 point of liability for each finding of fault that they make in a case. And in this case, they found the other boat operator to have 2 points of liability. At least he was found to be at fault in two respects, and the operator of our boat, 1 point. We filed a complaint, therefore, against the operator of the other boat, and immediately under the third-party pleading practice, the defense attorney joined as a defendant in the case of the operator of our boat, alleging that he was negligent. So it creates confusion immediately because we have to prove negligence against the operator of the offending boat, and the offending boat's attorney has to prove negligence against the operator of our boat so as to get a contribution from that operator or his insurance carrier in the event of a judgment in our favor. And we kind of look foolish if we don't name the operator of our own boat as a defendant in the case. So we name him as a defendant, but we have to allege that he was grossly negligent. And as a third-party defendant, they only have to prove that he was simply negligent, you see. So the jury is totally confused because now there's two standards of care that apply against the same operator of the same boat in the same incident. Now, Bonnie Warren is a case in point where the jury was given four different instructions on gross negligence and what it constituted in defining gross negligence. And it totally confused the jury, and it was a boyfriend-girlfriend situation where the boy got a little bit anxious and was driving 60 miles an hour in a 35-mile-an-hour zone, had a wreck, and she got seriously injured. And the jury found for the defendant in the case. In that case, the jury was instructed on the reckless theory, on the probability of harm theory, and what I like to define as the plunge theory, and the fourth one was the missile theory. Now, so that you'll see how easily the jury was confused, I extracted from that file this morning the four instructions, each one of which gave 12 jurors a different definition of gross negligence. And if I could approach you for just a moment, I'll just hand these out to you. You can see them.
They're all given by the same jury?
Yeah, all given to the same jury, by the same judge. Pardon?
By the same judge in the same evidence.
Yes. At the conclusion of the presentation of evidence, these instructions were given by the judge to the jury. And I just want to go over them with you so that you can see. The Oregon Supreme Court has at least defined or attempted to define in about 45 or 50 cases what constitutes gross negligence. And no one's yet sure what constitutes gross negligence. And we've got so many cases now which are purportedly landmark cases, each of which give a different definition, that no one now knows what really constitutes gross negligence. Now, the first instruction is one that we requested, which is simply the uniform bar instruction, which is the reckless theory. One who, gross negligence, for example, it states that line 4 is characterized by conscious indifference to or reckless disregard of the rights of others. And then it goes on to make that a little bit clearer, but you'll see that even within that one definition, there could be three jurors thinking, well, you have to prove that this way, and three jurors thinking, well, you have to prove that this way, and three more jurors thinking that you have to prove it that way, just in this one instruction alone. But the others show how easy, really, a jury can be confused. So if you go on to the second, and if you look down at line 10, you'll see that that definition of gross negligence says it means doing an act or failing to do an act which it is the driver's duty to do, under circumstances that would lead a reasonable man to realize that his conduct not only created an unreasonable risk of bodily harm to plaintiff, but also involved a high degree of probability that, quote, substantial harm, end of quote, would result to the plaintiff, meaning that the jury could be readily confused into believing that you don't have a gross negligence case unless you have a substantial injury. Yet, the actor or the tortfeasor, the driver, has to be cognizant before his conduct can be said to be grossly negligent, that substantial harm might result to his passengers. So that's the substantial harm theory. The third one is the plunge theory, which is rather a novelty, but nevertheless is promulgated under the doctrine of these four cases, which says at line 8, in talking about the state of mind of this person, the condition of mind of the driver who plunges on ahead, grossly negligent of the rights of the others, and displays, as it states on line 11 and 12, those rash qualities exhibited by the foolhardy, and an I don't care what happens mental attitude. And then the fourth one is the old missile theory, where it says that you've got a conscious indifference to the consequences. It's the difference between one who casts a missile intending that it shall strike another and one who casts a missile where he has reason to believe that it is extremely likely to strike another. Now, the public is fed up with this law for good reason. It's very unfair. I would like at this time, because it applies to the Sharon Hill case, to again approach the bench, so to speak, my profession, and
make them feel better too.
Yeah.
I'm sure it does. And hand you what appeared in the Oregonian following my client's case here. This is an editorial which attacks, on behalf of the public, to the Oregonian editorial writers, the result in Sharon's case. And I'll speak and address myself. I'm sorry.
Go right ahead.
To Sharon. Sharon Hill is a young lady, as you can see. She was about 16 years at the time of this accident. She was a high school student in the Hood River area. She was riding to school with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend had purchased a car during that summer and had exchanged the tires for it, and the tires on this vehicle were bald, the front tires. I withdrew these exhibits from the file of court. I'm going to hand it to you again in just a minute. It'll show the condition of the right tire, completely bald and having no measurable tread depth, and it'll show the left tire the same way, and this is a closer up of the same tire. Now, the way that this accident occurred was that Sharon was riding to school, and it was a cold, misty morning, foggy, and Hood River is different than it is in the Willamette Valley. And they tend to get ice, especially where there's a lot of trees that kind of act as a conductive force for the water to freeze onto the highway in this area, and jurors up there in that area, or prospective ones, are familiar with these conditions. And as he proceeded on to his school, his car lost control. According to the expert from Portland, the coefficient of friction was completely lost with the front tires. The plane crossed the road and it struck another vehicle head on. And you can see the various marks in this vehicle, but it impacts a heavier car, throws the smaller car up in the air. And so the way that this accident happened was that as these two vehicles collided together, the smaller vehicle was thrown clear up like this in the air with its rear tires off the road about 5 feet up above, and then they came down. Now, both the occupants of the other vehicle were killed. I can't remember the name of both of them, but I ended up later representing the estate of one of them, and his name was Joe Farley. And Sharon, who sits before you, doesn't look like she's been hurt very much, but she has. She had four operations, and she had a hip fracture, and she's got what they call diplopia. Diplopia of her left eye, which is double vision. And if she takes off her glasses, then she has double vision looking up, but not down. Now, it was before the trial, and at one time following the accident, was that she would have double vision when she looked down. But by a muscle tuck operation performed by a very competent doctor in Portland, that was reversed because people look down more than they look up, and therefore they could tuck the muscles and change the area of diplopia. But when she takes off her glasses now, she has double vision when she looks up. That's a permanent condition. And also she has a severe fracture of the zygoma, which is a cheekbone that's prominent over here in this area, and it's been wired for a long time, and there's some socket difficulties with her eyes, so that if you look closely at Sharon, the socket in her left eye is more recessed than it is in the right. Now, Sharon got an $85,000 verdict in this case by a unanimous jury who felt that there was gross negligence in the case, notwithstanding how many definitions of it that they were given. And the judge following the case entered what they call a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, which took away that verdict, he superimposing upon the jury his opinion that there was no gross negligence as a matter of law, so that Sharon actually had a trial by judge as opposed to a jury, even though she thought she was going to get a trial by a jury. And then, of course, we appealed here to the Supreme Court locally, and they affirmed the trial judge's decision in taking away that verdict. Now, the passenger in Mr. Farley's vehicle, or I can't remember who was the passenger, but the other person who was represented received $50,000 in that case from the insurance carrier, and Mr. Farley's estate received $100,000. And in that case, based upon one singular act of negligence, namely operating a motor vehicle on an icy road, knowing that the person who was operating the offending vehicle, knowing that his car presented a dangerous condition in that it had bald tires. The two persons who were not passengers in his vehicle or their estates recovered $50,000 and $100,000 respectively, and the girl who's alive that has yet to live her life was injured and got an $85,000 verdict that was taken away from her. And so, insofar as her case is concerned and her feelings on it, there's really no justification. And I'll just would like to show you, if I could, and I won't hold it up long, but just so they can see a little bit closer. These were the two vehicles that were involved in this collision of vehicles.
Sharon was in it yesterday. Yes, the one on the right.
Sharon
was
in this, and this car over here. And the two men that were killed were in the Opel, over here. Okay? And you'll see that this car has a crease mark in it, right here. And that crease mark was said to have been caused when this car went up like this and then came down again. Okay? This was the condition of this tire. And this tire was photographed at the wrecking yard within 24 hours from the time of this accident. And the defendant went down and surreptitiously removed this tire and the other front tire prior to the time that they could be seized, but in the interim, the investigator had measured them and had photographed them. But it still didn't make any difference because his conduct, even notwithstanding that, wasn't sufficient to constitute gross negligence, because all this conduct was an admission of fault, and fault in this particular case was held by the court to be only an admission of ordinary negligence, the most, because his conduct didn't constitute gross negligence, but the jurors felt that driving a vehicle with this kind of a tire was grossly negligent. And the court, all seven members of the Supreme Court of the state of Oregon, and the trial judge said, no, operating a motor vehicle on a highway, icy highway, with a tire like this, knowing of its condition, is not grossly negligent. And so, that's the problem.
Now, President Smith,
could you cite the Oregon Supreme Court case for me, please? Do you happen to have that?
Sharon Hill?
Yeah.
I cannot. I will be more than happy.
Would you apply it to counsel for the committee sometime?
I will.
In fact, if you just give me a title of it, I can look it up right now.
It was Sharon Hill versus David Max Garner, G-A-R-N-E-R. And it bears a circuit court number which prevailed into the Supreme Court of 6960.
Does Mr. Garner not hurt?
Minor injuries. Now, I don't have any... unless I'm asked questions, but I would like if the committee please, if Sharon might comment just briefly upon her feelings about what happened to her because of this law. Okay. She's a little bit nervous, but I told her that everybody here would understand.
It's probably a committee in the legislature. Don't worry a bit about that.
Yeah. Nobody bites
the hip. Identify yourself for the record before you speak. We have to type up minutes.
Okay, my name is Sharon Hill. And a while after the trial was over, my parents were talking to a gentleman that was on the jury. And he said that they were sure that the guy that I was driving with was grossly negligent. And then the judge overruled it. And I don't see how, you know, a judge could have so much say, so why even have a jury, you know? That's the way I look at it.
How long was the jury out?
I'd say approximately about two and a half hours, as I recall.
So it was not a difficult decision for a jury to reach in?
No, it was mainly on damages, I think.
Wait, Mr. Representative, were these four instructions given at that case?
No, they were given in another boyfriend-girlfriend case that I tried about 9 months later in Lane County. The problem being is that you could argue as an attorney that, hey, it's not fair to give the jury if each one of these instructions has about five different standards within itself. Taking all four together, you've got about 20 different standards. You could have one juror thinking, yes, that one of those 20 elements were established, or maybe one of 19, and the others ruling upon some other. You see, there's no concrete definition of gross negligence, and there always has been, of ordinary negligence, which is simply doing an act which a reasonable, prudent person would not do, or failing to act where a reasonable, prudent person would act, having a duty to act. But that's simple negligence. But when you get into gross negligence, they talk about, like a missile, probability of harm, reckless indifference. They equate it to criminal cases, and unfortunately, judges equate it to trying to find a guy guilty of reckless driving beyond a reasonable doubt, because it's equated to reckless driving. Gross negligence is reckless driving, basically, in the minds of the judiciary. And notwithstanding the fact that you got a burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence, the carryover from the criminal element makes it, you know, more likely than not that the probability is that you're going to get non-suited in a close case. Now, Sharon's parents had to fork up $4,100 to our law firm for the costs that were incurred in the case. That didn't have anything to do with, we didn't get paid anything. And we took the case through the trial level, investigative level, Oregon Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, which, you know, it's neither here nor there, because that's the bad part of the contingent fee, where otherwise there might be some good parts to it, too. But it was particularly unfair in her case, as it worked out.
I was interested in your remarks that the judges feel that reckless driving is what is required to meet the test of negligence. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that, as far as gross negligence.
And only that?
Yes.
Insofar as operation of the vehicle?
That's the basic test that's used.
Bill, that's a question for you or Sharon, if you feel comfortable answering it. One of the effects of the guest passenger law is to leave the damages suffered by the guests where they fall, as opposed to having them compensated by insurance to which other people contribute. In Sharon's case, I gather the medical costs and damages are at least $85,000, or I don't know what the medical bills are, but I assume they're substantial.
Yes.
Were those compensated in part by health insurance or any resources of the insurance company, or did some of them come from your family's pocket? Or
Some came through my parents' insurance company.
This was before PIP, I believe.
May I pursue that?
Representative Smith?
Would you describe for the committee what the results might have been, at least as to the medical special damages, had PIP been enforced at the time?
There would have been no difference, except that all of her medical bills up to the first $5,000 would have been paid.
By the driver's insurance company?
That's correct.
Either insurance company, depending?
No, just by her own drivers. PIP is another reason why the guest passenger statute should be abolished.
Would you speak to that more definitely?
Yeah. One of the reasons why, the two reasons, as I understand, why we have a guest passenger statute is for hitchhikers and fraudulent claims. The statute is enacted now that a passenger of a car, all motorists being required to be insured now, have to maintain medical insurance covering their passengers, or at least liability carriers have to issue policies covering passengers up to at least $5,000 in medical expenses, paying 100% of all medicals up to that amount for a period of 1 year from the date of the accident. Now, in view of the fact that a passenger can make a claim against her host insurance company for at least one up to $5,000 worth of medical expenses for a period of 1 year, and after a 14-day waiting period can make a claim for a loss of wages up to $750 per month for 1 year retroactive to the first day of disability if there's been at least 14, that would, then 70% of their salary not to exceed $750, plus $18 per day for household-related expenses if necessary for the welfare of the family. There could be fraudulent claims filed by the passenger against the host through his insurance companies, through his insurance company, by contending, for example, falsely that he's disabled and collecting these wage loss benefits. So, to that extent, there could still be fraud, and it's not eliminated in toto by the guest passenger statute, which is the main reason for its enactment.
Further questions from the witnesses? Thank you both.
Thank you very much for your time. Okay.
Tom Bessonet.
Ms. Hill was rather nervous about approaching the bench and talking to the legislator, and so am I, even though I've done this quite often. I feel somewhat like a lamb led to the slaughter, seeing as how I represent the insurance industry. I know that this is a very controversial law that is on our books now, and I can empathize with both sides. I started adjusting insurance losses.
Excuse me, Tom. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you.
I know you're nervous. We need
I am Tom Bessonette. I'm assistant to the president of Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. At this particular time, I'm speaking in opposition to House Bill 2306 on behalf of all the insurance lobbyists, so that there'll just be one spokesman, and we'll save some of your time. As I mentioned, I started, and I'm digressing from my prepared statement for a moment. I started adjusting insurance losses in 1950 in the state of Oregon, and have handled many of the guest passenger claims. When I denied the claims, I've also handled them when I have honored their claims because of what we consider to be gross negligence. It's not all one-sided, of course, because there are some people who win the guest passenger cases in a courtroom, and there are some who loses. There are some who lose just regular lawsuits because they are more negligent than the adverse driver. So no matter what happens, there will be some winners and some losers. Now I'd like to refer to my printed text. Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen of the committee, the insurance industry's opposition to the repeal of the guest passenger law is often misunderstood. You must be aware that we can and do operate with or without the guest law. Actually, that's in other states. Actually, we are trying to represent the many policyholders that do not understand what is happening here in Salem as advocates try to repeal the guest law. With a repeal of the guest statute would come about an increase in the insurance premium of approximately $6 million per year. This means that if you vote to repeal the law, then you are asking the insurance companies to pay an additional $6 million in claims. We, in turn, must increase the premiums by the same amount. Now, digressing from the prepared statement, but attached to it, I think on the last page of the is the addendum that we submitted from State Farm back in 1977 legislative session, and that has been updated with the increase in inflation of figuring 10% per year for 3 years since 1976. Even though the cost of living index has been less than 10%, the amount of business that we deal is in the area of medical insurance and medical expenses and things of this nature, and our cost has been at least 10 or maybe even higher. So by the time we compound that from the $5 million estimated in 1977, we now come up to $6,018,321 for the 1979 figure. I'd be happy to explain that if you have any questions about that exhibit. Probably the most direct implication of that we have from the public as to their views on the guest law is the fact that the motorcyclists reject coverage for their passengers 85% of the time. Now, I have a copy of a telegram that I'll be happy to leave. I only have one of them, I'm sorry, with the committee clerk. It is from Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, and it indicates several things. One of them, in 1976, only 13.2% of all of our insured selected guest passenger coverage when it was an option. Progressive averages liability premiums in 1976 was $35.67. Our average guest passenger premium, in other words, to cover the guest passenger, would have been $19.53. And
question at
okay.
this point. How much of that failure to provide for that insurance could be laid to some kind of lack of caring for the passenger as opposed to just one more premium that's charged? And I guess as a second question to that, if in fact the person had to have liability insurance to operate the motorcycle and it wasn't broken down, how many people have liability insurance that ride motorcycles? Most, if not all.
Answering your second question first, Progressive Casualty insures approximately 5% of the motorcyclists in Oregon. So they're talking about the people that they insure, which would be about 2,200 policyholders. In relationship to the coverage we're talking about, they already have the liability coverage, which covers them against the lawsuit of a guest passenger. The $19 would be for the benefit of the medical insurance and so on for the passenger, and that is being rejected by the operator of the motorcyclist. Now, I'm not sure how many of them are even carrying passengers, which would be the next logical question to ask. However, some of them do. We've seen families. When I was in the legislature, I introduced a bill to prohibit more than two people on a motorcycle, because I did see in 1967 many people riding three on a motorcycle, and I thought that was unbalancing a motorcycle. So some people do have their families on motorcycles, and yet they rejected coverages. Anyway, then from Universal Underwriters Insurance Company, again dealing in the area of motorcycles, they have guest coverage, which on the low side costs $12 a year, and on the high side costs $24 a year, and that's for Oregon. In New Jersey, where they do not have the guest law, the same coverages cost $30 on the low side to $109 on the high side. In California, in the rural areas of California, it's $46 against $241. In the metropolitan areas of California, it's $60 against $313. So it does have a high cost for covering the guest passengers. I'm sure that most members of the committee are acquainted with the fact that the passengers in Oregon are not without benefits. Under the current law, it is mandatory that any insurance policy issued to cover a vehicle in this state must have personal injury protection. This means that you have up to $5,000 medical expense, 70% of your wage loss, not to exceed $750 per month for 52 weeks of payment. Should they be killed in the crash, a minimum of $1,000 funeral expense. Should they not be gainfully employed, or should they be housewife, there is a up to $18 per day benefits for the replacement of the essential services provided by that individual. These benefits are payable irrespective of who is at fault for the crash, and even if it is a one-car wreck. Some of the proponents may claim that the law is unconstitutional.
Excuse me,
yes,
Chairman. I'm on the pit point. The benefits are payable irrespective of who is at fault.
Correct.
But there is an adjustment as between the insurance companies, is there not, that's ultimately made?
Yes, if fault is determined, then the company that has paid the claim to their insured has subrogation rights back against the
case. Okay. So my point is that even though, or I think my point is, I'm going to leave this, if there's a guest passenger allegation, then the passenger's PIP coverage pays the passenger, but the passenger's insurance company then can't go against the insurer of the driver who's at fault, can it? If it's a guest passenger example.
May I paraphrase it back? I heard two passengers in there one time. I thought it maybe should have been a driver versus a passenger.
A driver and a passenger.
If I'm correct in your question is that if you are a passenger in a car, mm-hmm, and A policy pays, then A could not segregate back against the B driver, because if B driver was simply was negligent, yes, he could segregate against B driver.
So the subrogation works irrespective of the existence of a guest passenger defense that would apply in an action if B sued A, or A sued B. Passenger sued driver.
Okay, if a passenger sues a driver, let's go on a one-car crash as an example. Maybe it'll clarify it. One-car crash. Passenger sues driver. Passenger has been paid $14,000 under the PIP benefits. He receives a $25,000 verdict, and it stands up because of gross negligence. PIP is then an offset against that payment, and the insurance company would owe an additional $11,000 under the liability portion of the policy. Are you with me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
No.
Okay. Repeat your question.
Same facts, except the lawsuit is not successful because they conclude there's only ordinary negligence and not gross negligence. All right. How much does the driver's insurance company pay the passenger's insurance company because of the PIP coverage?
The passenger's insurance policy would not be applicable at all in the crash. You claim from your own driver's policy, period. First, okay?
Yeah.
Therefore, the passenger would not have had any insurance involved in a PIP payment unless he and his company would pay any excess of any of the exhaustion of the driver's policy, and at that time, that's a voluntary payment and would not be subrogatable, to my knowledge. And if, even if it was, it would be on a basis of gross negligence. Okay? Thank you. Well, we've touched about the constitutionality of the law. See the attached list of some of the states that have more recently held the law to be constitutional. We are continually faced with the threat of the energy crunch. I wonder just how adversely the repeal of the guest law would affect motor car pooling. We are all in agreement that if a person furnishes a car and other people pay for the ride, they are no longer subject to the guest passenger law. However, if there were five people in the car and each week a different person drove, then I would question whether or not the carpool was in fact violating the guest passenger law. As a result of that, some of the people who believe that they can share the ride in a manner by sharing the driving responsibilities without circumventing the guest law or submitting themselves to substantial financial liabilities would in fact stop transporting other passengers. If this would not assist in the energy crunch but would compound it and would use more gasoline. I believe one of the greatest problems caused by the repeal of the guest law is the domino effect that it has on other laws. I'm referring specifically to the family immunity doctrine as well as the interspouse doctrine. In the state of Oregon, a parent cannot be sued for injuries to their child because of simple negligence. However, if a crash came along and the parent and had several children in the car, one of them being their own, since the other children would be paid for their injuries, the court would sooner or later rule that it was inequitable for the one child that was more severely injured not to collect merely because his parent was driving the vehicle. At that time, the domino would fall and the lawsuits would be initiated against the parent. I point out to you that this is a far greater consequence than automobile crashes. For example, a father teaching a child to ride a bicycle. If the child was injured while being instructed how to ride the bicycle, the medical expense would probably be paid by the health insurance carrier and everything would be reasonably well. However, let a divorce ensue in that family, and 52% of the families are now divorcing, an attorney would ask why the child was limping and would turn around and sue the father for his negligence. This would apply in all areas of life. Say you furnished the child a skateboard. You could even be sued providing them with a dangerous instrumentality. I could cite endless cases where the child could be injured, BB gun, slingshots, even basketball or football. With all these new, all of these would be opening a new opportunity for lawsuits against parents. I'm afraid that the social implications of this type of lawsuit is so far-reaching that it is undermining some of the support pillars of the institution known as a family.
Are you saying that if we vote for this, we're attacking motherhood? Is that what you're saying?
No, not directly. Representative.
And I'm afraid to turn this next page for apple pie. Is this here?
Well, if you're talking about suing your wife or your wife suing you, the next page covers that one, yes. The reason I say that is that in 50% of the states that have repealed the guest law or do not have a guest law, they allow this type of lawsuits.
Is that the result of court decisions following the repeal of the guest passenger law, or is that also an action of the legislature?
I cannot speak for all the other states because I don't know. As I recall, in Washington, they went almost simultaneously the same year through the court, through the Supreme Court decision on the guest law and the family immunity doctrine. I'm not positive in California the family immunity doctrine, as I recall, went first in California and then the guest law went second.
But you can't cite a situation in which the legislature has repealed the guest passenger statute and then the court has said, well, they repealed the guest passenger statute, so they probably meant to repeal spousal immunity, too.
No, I could not cite that.
You would also be willing to concede that since there are only 50% of the states that have done this, that these two are not inextricably entwined, that one has to fall in.
That's true. They are not tied together.
They may or may not be.
That's correct.
Chairman.
Representative Perlmutter.
Tom, how many states now have a guest passenger statute?
Those who claim that simple negligence would not allow recovery are 12.
So there's been very marked decline from the high water mark of 31 at one point, and the combination of legislative repealers and court decisions in recent years has really put Oregon down in a very tiny minority of states that still retains this device.
You could say that, yes.
I
don't know of being in a minority, however, at all, all the time.
Is family life a little bit more uncertain in those states where they repealed it?
I have lived in Oregon all of my life. I have no idea what the other states have, but I just in other states. Okay, let's see. The next doctrine to fall would be the interspouse, where one spouse was injured while the other one was driving the vehicle, and they would in turn sue the spouse that was driving. This certainly causes disharmony and could wreck a marriage. In 50% of the states that do not have the guest law, one spouse can sue the other. The state of Louisiana has recognized the problems created by this type of law and have limited the lawsuit, I should say, as to the extent of the insurance policy. To me, this is an admission that they are attempting to share the wealth and not bring about justice. If you are really asking about equity in lawsuits, instead of sharing the wealth, then let me cite an illustration of a simple little accident where vehicle A is traveling towards the intersection that has a traffic control device. With him is a passenger coming from his left at the same intersection with a red light facing it is vehicle B. Driver A, with a passenger, tries to go through the light, which is yellow. The driver B admittedly does not see the red light at all and crashes into driver A with a passenger. The passenger and the driver each receive substantial injuries that are worth $50,000. Driver A has only committed simple negligence. Under the current law, he is not sued by his passenger, but both of them sue driver B. The jury deliberates on the facts of the accident and determines that driver B is 95% at fault and that driver A has contributed 5% negligence for going through the warning light. Under the current law with comparative negligence doctrine, both parties could collect the passenger $50,000 from driver B and driver A $47,500 out of the $50,000 because of the 5% negligence. Everything is fine if the adverse party has insurance. Let's illustrate just for the sake of discussion that B does not have insurance. Now we look to the uninsured motorist coverage, and both injured parties receive $15,000 from the uninsured motorist on the vehicle in which they were riding. However, look at the inequity that is created by the repeal of the guest law. Under the same facts, passenger A sues both driver A and driver B. The jury returns a verdict for him for $50,000 against his own driver as well as driver B. Since driver B does not have liability insurance, the passenger then collects all the money, $50,000, from driver A. The host driver merely collects $15,000 on insured motorist, even though he was injured as severely. I submit to you that is not equity, that in reality, creating a new inequity. If you really want equity, then you would amend the law to allow the party to be held responsible only for the percentage of negligence that he has contributed to the entire crash. This, then, would bring about equity and not inequity, as when you are individually and jointly responsible merely because you are in the crash. It also brings about a greater justice when one person is held responsible for just their own negligence. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not feel that it is the intent of the legislators to create an inequity while passing a bill. That is what would happen with the passage of House Bill 2306. Since the repeal of the guest passenger law has been before the legislature since 1961, I would urge the defeat of this bill. Thank you very much.
Questions with Representative Smith?
Could you refresh us on the history then of this bill, perhaps not all the way back from 61, but tell us whether it has ever passed either body here?
Representative Smith, I researched at the last session. I don't know whether I turned them into the committee or not. I could not find my notes, but in 1961 it was adopted, and since that time it has been under attack. It was passed 1975, it was passed out of committee, defeated on the floor of the House. 1977, it was passed out of committee, passed the House, failed the first time on next day on reconsideration. It passed the House, I think it was 32-28. It then went to the Senate, was passed out of the Transportation Committee in the Senate, failed on the floor of the Senate 15-15, last session. That's a quick resume.
Further questions for the witness? Representative Dugan.
Tom, from what you said, the only thing that would happen if we repealed this would be that the insurance premiums would go up. And if we felt that equity was better served by eliminating the law, and it would cost more in insurance coverage, the companies would not be harmed, would they?
That's very true. That's the reason why the insurance industry's opposition to this bill sometimes just doesn't make sense, because we are the conduit by which monies are funneled from one person to another person to pay the bills. However, the biggest complaint that we have, and that probably you hear, is the fact that the insurance premiums are too doggone high now. You also, and that's why we're here sharing our insights into the bill.
Another question, Mr. Chairman. Tom, would you comment about the equity or lack of it in the case that Mr. Wiswold so lucidly put before us with that nice young lady there? Where's the equity in that?
I cannot, I thought about it while they were talking about the case. I really can't comment on it, because from their point of view, here before you today, I would say that an injustice had been done. I did not, however, sit on the jury. I did not sit in the Supreme Court to listen to all the fine arguments.
Assuming everything you told us. Yeah.
Well, I still only heard one side of the case.
Can I ask again?
Does the comment of Bill Whitlaw that the judges have a real problem with instructions on gross negligence, and he was about as blunt as I've ever heard a trial attorney dare to be, not knowing that there were any jurists in the building, about the inability, and I think he kind of categorically condemned the judiciary in the state about being unable to properly define gross negligence. Does that bother you? Or do you agree with him, for starters?
Well, I really don't know. I've never heard that statement before. I thought the definition was reasonably clear in the law. Apparently, great minds can differ. And since the law on gross negligence is defined, apparently they've tried to refine the definition of it, and they have their problems. However, that might be an administration problem, not a legislative problem. It could be solved by the legislature repealing the problem, yes. No question about that.
You yourself suggest that maybe we ought to consider comparative negligence.
No, refining comparative negligence beyond that which we already have, where one party is totally responsible only for his degree of negligence. If that were to be passed, I would have no objections to the guest passenger repeal, because then we would have equity all the way through.
You're saying then that you don't believe that the argument about fraudulent claims has any merit?
I have never used that argument before the legislature in opposition to it. Yeah. No, I have never. There are fraudulent claims presented in all areas of the insurance industry, because we are dealing with people, and some people are honest people and some people are just out after the dollar. Anybody who is seriously hurt is only talking about the value of that injury, not the fact that they were not hurt. And so I really don't put a lot of strength in the fraudulent claim theory on injuries that are demonstrable.
Second question. Do you feel that people consciously, in carpooling situations and other situations where they give people a ride, consciously think about what their terms of liability are before they give them the ride?
In the testimony at the Senate in 1977, Chairman Gardner, carpool, which is a phrase used in the metropolitan area, testified in opposition to the repeal of this bill because some of their people had reacted adversely to it. That's why I quoted that part of my statement.
Isn't it also true that if each one was contributing certain monies towards the operation of the carpool, suppose they collected money each time, they would come take themselves out of the guest pass dispatch altogether?
I believe that's true. That's why I drew the definition of the difference of sharing the car and one person furnishing the car all the time. One person furnishing the car all the time, I think they've moved out from underneath the guest law already.
So, if we took the argument that there's an inequity in the way that the money are distributed, plus the other problem is the higher premiums, if we could work out some way to distribute the money more equitably, you would feel that the inequities that are presently occurring would outweigh the problems with the premiums and the problems with people not perhaps writing.
I think that, yes, in effect, from what I understand of what you said, I agree with it. In other words, with the advent of comparative negligence doctrine, which I wholeheartedly endorse, I think that it can be refined to more equitably reflect fault. And with that, we can also go away with some of the doctrines of yesteryear, which we have already done under strict liability and so on. So I think that we are making advances, and I have been one that always favored good advancements.
So basically we're at the position where we should really be looking at another piece of legislation, perhaps in this committee, to try to deal with how we're distributing the money and pass this bill out.
Look at and pass out are two different things. No, I think that this would be a good step forward to look at another concept of individual responsibility. Representative Frohmeyer in 1975 improved the comparative fault law. Didn't go quite far enough.
Would you want to go to pure comparative negligence, Tom?
No.
You want to stick with the 49 or 51?
With individual responsibility, yes. The other one, well, excuse me, that's not before us.
One last question. Aren't there inequities really in any law in the sense that when you apply it, you know, in every case, that you can't achieve uniformity?
You'll have inequities, yes, such as the next party that maybe you repeal the guest law and the individual has the $85,000 injury that Ms. Hill had and they got $15,000 coverage. I mean, there's a $70,000 inequity built into it because of failure to have enough insurance. So we're never going to continually remove all inequities.
Further questions?
Tom, I know I see a couple other members in the industry in the building, in the room. Do you know, are your remarks those of the reflective of the attitude of the industry, or are you strictly talking for arguments?
The opposition to House Bill 2306 is representative of the insurance industry that's represented by the lobby. We can't speak for State Farm and some of the people that are not represented here at all. However, normally speaking, the insurance lobby that is represented here in Salem is in opposition to this. The statements I have made relative to the refinement of the law of equity or individual fault is my own statement, and I'm not positive that that's represented because I would yield the guest passenger law with my refinement.
Further questions for witness? Thank you.
Thank you.
J. Michael Alexander.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm also a practicing lawyer here in town, a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm with the firm of Brown, Burton, Swanson.
Please identify yourself.
My name is first initial J. Michael Alexander, Mick Alexander, what I go by. I'm here to try to comment on a few of the legal issues that have been raised about these type of bills. You've exhibited some interest in the history of it. I'm not going to try to go through a extensive rundown of it, but I think I can summarize what's happened to these bills, when they came about, how they've been criticized by other states, and what's happened to them. I have some information here. This is not like reading the newspaper, but there's a couple of law journal articles. This isn't always the most enjoyable reading, but both of these talk about the guest passenger statutes nationwide, how they've been criticized, which ones have been repealed, things like that, and give you a pretty good history, I think, for some discussion, if I might bring these forward. And just a little bit about these laws, I think it was indicated that most of them were passed back in the 20s and 30s, and there's been two basic justifications for the laws. One is the hospitality argument, it's not very nice to sue your host, and the other is the argument that you're going to have collusive suits, people get together and stage accidents and file flimsy lawsuits. I think the insurance representative said the collusive suit type argument has really been abandoned, and I think the Oregon Supreme Court in Durst versus Limbacher, which is the case, or one of the cases that has recently upheld this statute, also said they can't really see any reason or any justification on the collusive suit issue to sustain these laws. But the Oregon Supreme Court did say that if the legislature feels that the hospitality argument is still one that's viable, then it's up to the legislature whether they want to change the law. And that's been the position of the Oregon Supreme Court. And just a comment in passing about some of this domino theory that was espoused here, I think that the legislature is probably aware that our courts are not inclined to go legislating. Our courts have always taken the position that the legislative function is one that they don't want to interfere in. The Durst versus Limbacher case certainly shows that position of the courts, and the courts are certainly not going to go overturning laws. They'll leave that up to the wisdom of the legislature, as I feel they should. Now, a number of these laws, since, as I say, I think they were all passed back in the 20s and 30s, a number of them have been either repealed or found unconstitutional. And I think probably about half the states where the constitutional issues were raised, about half of them said they're unconstitutional, and half of them said we'll leave it to the legislature. And then the legislature repealed a number of those laws. And I think right now the figure of about 12 states is probably accurate. And there were probably 24 or 25 that had these laws 30 to 40 years ago. I only have a single copy, but I have copies of cases. Again, this is not necessarily enjoyable reading, but case of Brown versus Merlo, which is a California Supreme Court case that overruled their guest passenger statute. It does talk about a lot of these policy questions, and I think does a pretty good job. And I have a copy of Durst versus Limbacher, which is the Oregon case, which basically gives Oregon's position, if I might submit these as well.
Yeah, we'll have copies so we can distribute to members of the committee. Represent me. Very briefly, could you give us the rationale of the California case as opposed to Oregon case, if you can do that?
I hope I can do that rather quickly. The California case, these cases have been challenged on the issue of equal protection. In other words, you're treating a guest differently from everyone else. If someone else is hit as a pedestrian or in their car, then they can bring an action against the driver based upon ordinary negligence, whereas a guest, just because of his status as a guest, has to sue in gross negligence as opposed to ordinary negligence. So the argument has basically been that violates equal protection. You're saying you're taking one group of people and you're discriminating against them, saying they have to prove gross negligence. When you make an equal protection argument, you have to find some basis, legislative basis, to make that distinction between different groups of individuals. And the California court and the other courts that overturned these through the courts said that we can't see any rational basis, which is, I think, the legal terminology used, for this distinction. And they said that based upon a couple of arguments. One, they said the collusive suit argument isn't really viable. People can bring collusive suits under the guest passenger statutes by just lying about whether they've paid or not. So if you're going to have people who are going to come and perjure themselves, they can do it in a number of ways, and they can do it in many situations. As to the host situation,
excuse me. Do you mind if I interrupt you with a question?
No.
Has Oregon guest passenger statute ever been tested on constitutional basis for equal protection?
Yes, it has. That's the Durst versus Limbacher case, which I have submitted. And in that case,
that's sort of the rationale the court used, the one that you've just given us.
The Oregon court did not overturn it. The Oregon court, on the issue of
California, did.
California did, and there's a number of other states, and they're outlined in those law review articles. And I would say there's five or six states found it unconstitutional in the past 3 or 4 years. But the collusive suit argument, I will say the Oregon Supreme Court says there's no basis for a statute based upon collusive suits. In other words, they have accepted this argument that makes no sense because you can do it through a guest passenger statute. But they did say the other rationale for these statutes is that is a hospitality argument, that a a guest shouldn't be allowed to sue his host because it's just inhospitable. And the Oregon Supreme Court said if the legislature feels that that's a social interest that's valid enough to protect through legislation like this, then we're going to leave it up to them whether they want to change it.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative?
Is there any analogy here between the slip and fall on the doorstep in suing your host, and therefore your homeowner policy coverage is going to protect the homeowner from his guest's accident? Aren't they somewhat the same thing?
They're somewhat the same. I didn't really review that. There is some different standards of care for...
For a guest invitee?
Invitees and licensees, okay. Although that distinction is being faded somewhat. It's been eliminated in California, and I didn't review the Oregon law as to licensees and invitees. Again, it's just, I don't think that it's very valid in this day of insurance. 40 years ago, a lot of people may not have had insurance, and you're suing a host. That may be inhospitable if you think that it's socially undesirable, but suing an insurance carrier, your host's insurance carrier, is no different from claiming against his PIP policy, which he's allowed to do now. One of the other persons testifying here talked about the problems with gross negligence. And believe me, there is a problem with gross negligence, how to define it, how to properly define it. And I'm glad that he talked about it because I would have gotten myself pretty confused trying to get into it. But there have been a lot of cases, and they've talked about different standards, and we're to the point where we have a standard of reckless disregard of rights and a conscious disregard of things. We also have cases that say a combination of acts of ordinary negligence might be gross negligence. So you have gross negligence that's very difficult to define. But besides gross negligence, there's a problem, both in definition and kind of a problem that leads to some anomalous results, in the definition of both guests and in the definition of passengers. Now, a guest, the obvious instance is when you pay someone to take you somewhere. You're not a guest, then you're a paying passenger. But payment is not the only thing that takes you out of the guest passenger statute and makes you a passenger as opposed to a guest, and I'll use those terms, passenger and guest. If the driver, the cases have said, if the driver is motivated by something other than hospitality, then you're not a guest, you're a passenger. And one of the cases is that there was an individual who had to go find some fishing nets or something like that. And so the passenger said, I can show you where they are. So he says, come on, they drive and there's an accident. That passenger was a passenger, not a guest. Because even though he wasn't paying, the driver was motivated by something other than hospitality. So that's a difficult situation. And the idea of being a passenger is also one that it may be not as difficult, but you come up with some, I think, strange results. If you're going to the movie with a friend, and when you're riding in his car to the movie, he runs into a telephone pole, you're probably a guest, and if it's ordinary negligence, you can't recover. If you're standing out in your driveway when he comes to pick you up, he doesn't see you and runs over you, you're not a passenger there, and you can sue him in ordinary negligence, and you can recover. I don't think that the distinction there is one that's very important, and I don't think it's one that should be made. We have another example of this issue of a guest or not. Let's take the normal example of, I want to take my car down to be serviced, and I want you to come take me home when I leave my car off. So you're driving your car down the station, I'm following you. You stop at a light and I rear end you. You can sue me in ordinary negligence, and I think that that's proper. But let's say I'm going to pick my car up, and I say, will you give me a ride? You say, sure, just doing it from hospitality. Then you drive down, run into a telephone pole. Well, then I can't sue you if it's only ordinary negligence, because I'm then a guest. So you have results like that that I don't think really make much sense under the law. And again, we get into factual problems and legal problems of trying to define what a guest is and what a passenger is, compounded by the problems of trying to define gross negligence to a jury. And it's very difficult.
Question at this point. Do you think that there might even be savings to the, I guess, the premium payers in the sense that there might be less litigation or settlements?
There could,
we're working on a standard of simple negligence, and we get beyond these problems of who's a guest and who's grossly negligent.
I think that might be a good point. I'd like to say that I have something that I could, where I should say definitely that'll be the case, but I'd just be speculating, but I think it is a good point. A lot of times, trying to prove gross negligence involves a more difficult legal task and involves more protracted litigation and does discourage settlement, because I think from a defense standpoint, you always have a shot at beating gross negligence. And a lot of times, ordinary negligence is relatively clear, and the case might be settled. So from the point of litigation costs, that might be a point. And one other, if I can keep on this thing of taking you down to pick up your car when you've had it serviced, another thing that comes up that again makes this law seem to be not really an equitable one, take the same situation where you got your car down in the service station and you need a ride to pick it up, but you've got two cars. So instead of asking your friend, I'm not going to come to you and say, give me a ride. I'm going to drive my car and say, Mr. Smith, come with me so that you can bring my second car home, because I have to pick up my new car. In that case, I'm not necessarily motivated by hospitality and giving you a ride. I'm asking you to do me a favor. So in that case, I drive down and run into the telephone pole. You're not a guest, and you can sue me in ordinary negligence. But if I ask you for a ride so that we could pick up my car, and then you go down and you run into the telephone pole, then you're motivated only by hospitality. So I can't sue you in ordinary negligence. Those are the type of problems that we have to face every day, and those are the type of problems that our clients have to face. And under just little twists in the facts like that that don't really mean anything, we have people like Ms. Hill, who is here, who are deprived of recovery. And that's really why we're here. I mean, the argument can always be made that we have a vested interest in these types of cases, and it's true to a certain extent. But it's these individuals who are going to lose out, and they're going to lose out, like I say, just by little factual twists that shouldn't have that big an impact on them.
Questions for the witness?
I was interested, especially by your last remark, you know, having a vested interest in a frank observation in a fair one. Are you a plaintiff's attorney by pretty much in your practice?
The firm I work with is essentially a plaintiff's attorney as to my own practice that I have within the firm. I don't do that many automobile cases, but I wouldn't want to mislead you. The firm I work with, and of course I'm with the group, we do automobile cases. I don't have any cases right now where I'm representing a guest. I think we have some of them in the office.
Do you do some defense work also?
No.
Is it fair to say that plaintiff's attorneys almost unanimously argue, as you do, that the guest statute ought to be repealed, but that the defense attorney to defend for the insurance companies do not want it repealed?
I couldn't speak for the defense attorneys, and I don't, unless they would, their clients or the insurance companies, I think that they would perhaps be in an uncomfortable situation saying they would like to repeal the guest statute, but I don't know philosophically how they may stand on that.
Further questions for the witness? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Keith Burns.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Keith Burns. I'm here representing the Oregon State Bar. My comments will be very brief, and I'm afraid not very helpful. The last time the Oregon State Bar considered this legislation, they supported it, and that was their position at the last session of the legislature. However, they have not considered this at their last two annual meetings, and therefore, at this time, they have no position on this legislation.
Or the bill, excuse me.
At the last session, they did.
Support of the repeal.
Yes. But they have no position on this legislation, this session of legislation.
Further questions for the witness?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dick Bogue.
Chairperson, I believe my name is next on the list. My name is John Heeman. I'm an attorney here in Salem. Mr. Bogue was formerly a client of mine, so I took the liberty of signing his name in, too. I hope you don't mind that we're both up here at once, because we've really only got one short story to tell. As I said, I'm an attorney here in Salem, Oregon, with the law firm of Garrett Seidemann, Heeman & Robertson. Briefly, I was contacted last night, rather at last moment, to see if it was possible for me to arrange for Mr. Bogue to be present. I hesitated when the request was made of me, because I lived with Mr. and Mrs. Bogue through a rather traumatic period of their life. when their 15-year-old daughter, Terry, was involved in an automobile accident here in Salem as a guest passenger in a vehicle that was being operated by another young man. It wasn't easy for that family to go through that trial, and that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to come here today and bring Mr. Bogue with me to let him express his feelings and the feelings of his family about the guest passenger statute and what it meant in their own personal lives. Briefly, we were one of the lucky ones. I don't have a horror story to tell about not being able to obtain some compensation for this family for their terrible loss. Their daughter was 15, a student who did well in school, a bright, cheerful child, and she was killed in the automobile accident when she was riding in the front seat of a car that was coming down Madrona Avenue, and the evidence showed that he was grossly exceeding the speed limit in the area. And when it came to its intersection with Croyson Creek Road, where he had either had to turn left or right, apparently in an attempt to try and make a right-hand turn at an excessive rate of speed, he plowed straight into an embankment or cliff on the other side of the street. It was really a T-intersection collision. Single car, no other vehicle involved. Representative Gardner, your question to the last witness about whether or not there would be a reduction in the number of lawsuits that were litigated if there were some change in this legislation, I think was a very good point and was the main reason why I wanted to come down here. When this case first came into the office, we took a hard look at it, and gentlemen whose opinions I respect very greatly told me, don't touch it. It's a guest passenger case. We have no evidence of alcohol use, drug usage, no evidence of engaging in a speed contest. It looks like simply excessive speed alone. And you're going to get beat to death, quite frankly, if you take this case on. We didn't stop there, though. We knew the case cried out that this was gross negligence, even if we couldn't put our finger on exactly why. The cases that had been decided by the Supreme Court up to that time had talked about what the standards of gross negligence would be, that reckless, I don't care attitude, the indifferent willingness to accept substantial risk to others, but it didn't specifically talk about a combination of negligent factors which, when you add them all up together, could produce gross negligence. In this case, the young man had a clear vision for approximately a quarter of a mile of the intersection. There was a sign halfway down a hill, because when you come down Madrona, it's a rather steep hill to that T-intersection, and there's a sign that says stop ahead. You can also see down to the intersection from a quarter mile away, and you can see arrows that say you've got to go left or right. You can see the cliff behind the T-intersection, so you know you can't go straight. We had a witness testify that the young men went by her house at what she guessed at about 60 miles an hour in that area, and it was a developing residential area at that time. With this combination of factors, the Marion County Circuit Court allowed the case to go to a jury, gave them the standard instructions, which we were very surprised, delighted I might say, to let it get to a jury. The jury agreed there was gross negligence. The case went up on appeal on the question of whether or not the judge really should have let this combination of negligent acts issue go to the jury and let them decide whether there was gross negligence. And also on another question unrelated to the ultimate issue of gross negligence, but on an instruction. The Supreme Court agreed in what some people now refer to as a landmark case that a combination of negligent acts can produce gross negligence. They remanded it back for another trial, though, on an issue involving an instruction regarding what the maximum speed was in that area. And prior to the time that another trial was had on the question, the case was ultimately settled. That process, though, took about 2 years to complete, during which time Mr. and Mrs. Bogue lived through, I know, a great deal of agony. I am convinced that if the guest passenger statute were repealed, if this young lady, this 15-year-old girl, let's say she's 16, since that's the only age she could drive legally alone, but if she'd been coming up Croyson Creek Road in her own vehicle, and this young man had come down Madrona and plowed into the side of her car and killed her, that case would have been settled in an instant. There would have been no question about any kind of comparative negligence or anything else. And I'm citing really the same example that all the other witnesses had, and I don't want to take too much time on it, but I'm convinced there would have been less docket crowding, there would have been less upset to the family, there would have been better service and more justice done to the estate of this girl and to her parents. There would have been a substantial saving in litigation costs,
in this whole matter if the guest passenger statute hadn't been in existence. I, unlike Mick Alexander, who practices in the same building, do some defense work, not necessarily automobile accident defense, but I do some workers' comp defense work, and I know the general theory of defense work, and I can't blame the defense industry when they see a case involving guest passenger statute where there's no drug usage, no alcohol usage, and no definite evidence of a speed contest for defending the case and defending it right to the wall, because the odds are on their side, they're probably going to win. And you can't berate them or look down upon them for trying to protect their premium payments that are paid into their company. But this is a case that I thought would show you some of the example of why this statute needs to be done away with. It could have affected a substantial saving in court time and expense. Mr. Bogues here, I went and picked him up today because his truck's in getting fixed up, but he wanted to come and tell you a little bit about what his feelings are about the whole case.
Bogues?
I might just make one comment.
Representative
Smith.
Did you ask Mr. Bogues to pay you anything for the ride over the Capitol?
No, but I see members of the insurance industry in the room, and I'm confident they'll take care of me if I am guilty of gross negligence.
Okay. My name is Dick Bogue, and I live at 2457 La Jolla Northwest, and I'm here at the request of my attorney, John Heeman. And I was glad to come here because I have views on this matter that I feel are pertinent to this bill. My daughter was killed in an accident, an unforgiving accident, just before she turned 16 years of age. And you say, why do I say unforgiving? Because that accident should not have happened. That young man was driving a vehicle, an unsafe vehicle, by his own testimony, on a public highway in a residential area marked 25 miles per hour. This young man, out driving a vehicle that he says is not fit to be on the road, driving at a high rate of speed by witnesses saying so, because of a loud noise, the car wasn't equipped with Smitty-type mufflers, if you know what they are, so the only loud noise they heard was that engine winding up, if you know what I mean by winding up, as high as it could go. Now, the attorney for this young man states because after that vehicle hit that telephone pole, stopped at 40 miles per hour, that's what he was doing, was 40 miles per hour. I know better. I know what cars do. I've worked on cars all my working life. That young man had that car floorboarded. That car was airborne. Evidence proves it was airborne. Skid marks. One side and then another. And because of this young man's driving, my daughter lost her life. And I'm also here to say that I am against any laws that govern just passengers in a vehicle, because it doesn't give them an equal chance. It gives the insurance companies another edge. And if they lose that edge, it's going to mean that much more they pay out.
Questions for witness? Thank you, sir.
I'm not through yet, if you don't mind. I have a lot to say here yet. The only people that benefit by this guest passenger laws or statutes are insurance companies. And this House Bill 2306 is passed, they're going to lose another edge. An edge that's going to hurt them. And the only way they're going to be hurt is in their pockets. Money. That's the only thing that hurts them people. Now, Mr. Tom Bethesher said that there are losers and there are winners. Well, I have to disagree with him. There are no such thing as winners. There's only losers when there's somebody hurt or killed in a car accident. And when he was referring to as winners and losers, what he was referring to was money. Winners being those who receive money, losers those being the ones that don't receive money. Now, if that's what you call a winner or a loser, then I think that man's in the wrong business. Insurance companies, even if they win or lose, if they feel there's any fault there with the person holding their policy, they'll tell the policyholder before, say, you don't admit any guilt, then after it's all over, then they will take action against him. They'll either cancel him out or they'll put him in a risk. Now, so they themselves believe that he's not a good driver, but yet, if it goes to court, why, he's a principal person, man. He's done nothing wrong. Vince Wheeler, the plaintiff in this case, and he was a defendant, they tried in every way that they could to run my daughter down. They tried to say she was a drunk. She tasted some wine. She drank a little wine. They tried to say she was an alcoholic or a dope addict. She tried pot. What kids nowadays don't try drinking and don't try pot? They did everything they could to run down my daughter, to make it justifiable because of her death. But being we were the plaintiffs, we couldn't say anything bad about the other kid. He was a principal guy. I have nothing more to say. I'm just getting too mad because if I go on, I'll say what I really feel.
Questions of the witness? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Lady Bill.
Is there any comment? Ed Hughes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ed Hughes, Oregon Motorcycle Dealers Association. I wasn't going to talk today. I am not very well prepared. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not an insurance man, but there are a lot of professional people here in the room today. And I understand that, and I read the committee, and I feel that they feel strongly about passing this bill out. When I talked to the chairman about the bill, he said it's like a guided missile, it's going to fly. However, I do need to reiterate, I think, a point that may have been glossed over, not intentionally by the committee, or Mr. Bessonette, who mentioned it, and that is there is a problem with this particular bill for both a motorcyclist and a bicyclist in Oregon. At last count, in estimated motor vehicle division figures, we have roughly 250,000 motorcyclists in Oregon. We have probably, and I don't know for sure because they don't register them, double that many bicyclists. Washington County has about 40,000 motorcyclists in that area out there, and Lane County has about the same.
40,000?
Yes. So what we're thinking about here is that a repeal of the guest passenger law is critical to the motorcyclist, primarily because we feel, and we have some substantiation from insurance carriers who write motorcycle insurance, that it will quadruple insurance premium for the motorcycle. I think this is a problem. I think when you go to buy a...
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I think we have some testimony from Mr. Bessonette that one carrier that carries motorcycle insurance says the annual premium would be $19 a year for guest passenger coverage. Mr. Bessonette, could you come up for a second?
Yes, but he also stated in the other information that we furnished the committee that in the metropolitan areas it's substantially different. And he did say that one of the highest rates there was, I think, as I recall from his testimony, $265. Now, when the insurance gets to be the same price as the motorcycle, we have a problem. It fills the marketplace. And that's the point I wanted to drive home. And Mr. Bessonette, come on up. You're welcome.
Can we have clarification on that?
Yeah. I'm Tom Bessonette. The question was, Mr. Chairman, would you repeat it?
Well, your testimony, as I understood it, was that the increase that was guest passenger insurance offered to people who drive motorcycles, and that the cost of that insurance was an additional $19 a year above the liability coverage.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
That's in Oregon, right. That's as of 1976. Your clerk has, the legal counsel of the committee, has the document that I used. But that's right. That's for the medical expenses.
For just insurance. Medical.
Right. The liability policy already covers them in case of gross negligence.
Okay.
Now, I was just going to point out as
they,
okay, you want to do it?
No, you do it right here.
PIP insurance, mandatory PIP insurance on automobile policies does not apply to motorcycles. It specifically is excluded from the law that motorcycles are not to carry PIP insurance. That's why they have the choice between whether or not they cover their passengers or do not cover their passengers.
That's the problem. Motorcycles are specifically excluded in the law from PIP coverage. I felt that someone had to speak, you know, for the people. There are a lot of professional people that talk today, but what we're looking at is a significant rise in rates when you repeal this law, and it goes out to the public, and somebody gets their insurance bill in the mail, and it's three or four times what it was last year, and you're going to have mad people over this. So I would recommend that the committee look closely at some other method, and perhaps the modification of the gross negligence statutes and a better, clearer definition or cleaning up of that would be an answer. I just don't think it, based on previous sessions, every session we're faced with the same thing. I think you've got to take another direction if you want to accomplish your purpose. And that's basically the gist of my
question for the witness, Representative Davis. If we pass out the bill that's been introduced, putting, and I don't know how it was ever repealed, making helmets mandatory, wouldn't that cut this down?
No comment to make on.
I'm serious. And you're talking about people being injured on motorcycles, and somehow they repealed that provision last time. I wasn't here in Hawaii.
Well, I can talk specifically to injury on motorcycles. It's been proven, and we have the figures to show that in 75%, roughly, of the cases, it's the fault of the automobile driver, not the motorcycle. That's all I have. I have no comment on helmets. I'm specifically directed by my board of directors to take a neutral position. I'm sorry.
Okay, further questions for the witness? Thank you. Dominic Vetri?
My name is Dominic Vetri. I live at 24580 Gap Road, Brownsville. For identification and information purposes only, I'm a professor of law at the University of Oregon Law School. So, Chair Gardner and members of the Judiciary Committee, at the outset, I'd like to make a general statement. It seems to me that in our society, in the negligence area, we've come to this general understanding that if a person is an accident victim, their medical losses, wage losses, and pain and suffering losses are to be borne by them unless they can establish the negligence of some third party, in which event, if they do so, those losses are then shifted to that third party. The guest passenger statute changes that traditional rule. What it does is it says those losses remain on the victim unless the victim can show gross negligence. So in most cases, what it does is keeps the losses on the victim instead of transferring them to the shoulders of the tortfeasor, the third party. And a very interesting thing is that our society has been fairly effective in developing a mechanism and a system for dealing with those losses when they fall on the tortfeasors, the third parties. We've developed a liability insurance mechanism in which the loss really doesn't fall on that third party. It's spread out among all the insureds of that company so that each bears the loss in partial amount through the payment of premium. It falls into, if I might characterize it as such, an efficient channel of administration and distribution of the loss. On the other side of the equation, unfortunately, our society has not been as effective in dealing with the problem. And it's been effective in dealing with slight injury victims, but wholly inadequate in dealing with serious injury victims. And that's really what we're talking about here today, the guest passenger who's a serious injury victim, and those are the people that are going to be benefited most by the repeal of this legislation, if you should choose to do so. Let me explain what I mean. Most people, about 80% of the American population, based on national statistics, have Blue Cross insurance, which gives them coverage for hospitalization and surgical benefits. So most people in an accident would be covered for hospitalization, albeit up to a limited time, a year or whatever is provided in the Blue Cross policy. With regard to wage loss insurance, disability insurance, the figure is not as good. Only about 50% of Americans are covered for wage loss benefits. Moreover, the wage loss programs are really inadequate because most people are covered only for about 3 months up to 6 months of wage losses under whatever disability plan they have typically with their employer. The third area, though, which is a useful area and a very important area in Oregon, is the PIP benefits. Oregon law provides up to $5,000 medical benefits within a year of the accident, $750 a month wage loss up to a maximum of 12 months. Pardon? Well, not for motorcyclists, of course. They're exempted under the statute. So what we're talking about are those people who fall outside of those maximum benefits and who can establish negligence, notwithstanding are not able to put that loss in an efficient channel of administration. The excess losses beyond that minimum coverage fall on that victim because they can't shift it to the tortfeasor, the person that conceitedly might even be found to be negligent, and put it on the liability insurance system. If I might, I'd like to say something about the financial aspect of it, too. First of all, it would be inaccurate to assume that under the present law, guests don't recover, and therefore that's not included in insurance premiums, and that if you repeal the statute, guests would recover, and that would be included in the insurance premiums. PIP coverage already exists, up to $5,000 and the $750 per month for 12 months. For people who are covered by PIP insurance, and it's an interesting fact, about 90% of accident victims will have all of their medical expenses and wage losses covered by that PIP insurance. There's only a very small percentage of accident victims whose losses, whose out-of-pocket losses, pain and suffering excluded, medical expenses and wage losses would not be covered by the PIP insurance. So we're talking about a small percentage of people. To the extent that we're talking about that 90% group who have their PIP coverage, which covers them in full for their out-of-pocket expenses, to the extent that 90% included some guests, those guests are already included in the insurance premiums because we pay for the PIP coverage insurance premiums. Some guests can prove recklessness. To the extent that they prove recklessness and get judgments, those losses are included in the premiums we pay today. Some guests win against other drivers. It's a two-car accident, and they may be able to prove the negligence of the other driver, or even the carelessness of the manufacturer of the car, if there might be a product liability claim involved. Those losses are shifted into the insurance mechanism and already covered by the premium structures. And moreover, as has already been pointed out, parental and spousal immunity would bar a great preponderant number of claims. The mere fact of the abolition of this law would not affect the parental and spousal immunity laws, and under the Oregon law, those people would continue. Those types of guests would continue to not be covered. And interestingly enough, even if there weren't parental and spousal immunity, the typical automobile liability insurance policy in Oregon today excludes liability coverage for relatives and other third parties living in the same household as the driver. So you'd have the barrier of the immunity laws and the barrier of the contract that the spouse would not be able to recover, nor would the child be able to recover, nor would somebody living in your same household. And it seemed to me if you put all that together, it would indicate that the statistics that we've heard about a $5 million increase may not be accurate. I have no basis of evaluating that other than in the last session of the legislature, letters were sent out to quite a few states that had abolished the law, and an attempt was made to see what its impact would be. And my recollection was that most of the states wrote back saying that there was no discernible impact on the premium rate structure. And the literature in the law reviews would tend to indicate that there has been no discernible impact on that basis. The two, I'm not going to trouble you to continue articulating all of the concerns. I think the collusive lawsuit rationale has been indicated to us that even the insurance industry would not tend to rely upon that now. If I could speak to the hospitality rationale just for a few minutes and give you two examples that I think are significant. Oregon has abolished charitable immunity. And that means that a person who gains the benefit of free medical services in a charitable hospital, if those services were performed negligently, would be permitted to sue the hospital. We don't have a statute that says that's inhospitable. That's a showing of ingratitude, and you can't sue even though you could prove negligence. It seems to me it's an unfair treatment. It's distinguished between... That's a clear case where hospitality was accorded and ingratitude may very well be identified, and yet we don't have a par situation there. I think any analogy to the land occupier cases really argues for repeal of this statute. If I were to invite you to my home to sunbathe on my lawn, and I was quite careless when I was using my rotary lawnmower and watching some event that was happening in the street, and I carelessly went over your toe with my rotary lawnmower, you would be able to sue me and collect in Oregon, even though you were a licensee, a guest in my home, because you were actively negligent. There's an exception for that. That if a person is actively negligent towards licensees on the property, you're entitled to collect. I would dare say that the great majority of automobile accident cases involve active negligence on the part of the driver. And that if anything, the land occupier cases call for a repeal of the statute rather than its continuance. I think, as my memo indicates, there's an incompatibility of this legislation with the recent changes in the comparative negligence area. I think the legislation's incompatible with the PIP law. The PIP law mandates medical and waste loss coverage for guests. Hasn't the legislature indicated that the ingratitude argument is not worthy of consideration by mandating that it's compulsory now in Oregon, because auto liability insurance is compulsory, the PIP insurance now becomes compulsory. So the anomaly is that you're saying you have to pay the $100 claim, but the seriously injured guest who has $100,000 of out-of-pocket expenses will not be able to seek recovery, even though they could prove the negligence of the driver, but not the gross negligence or the recklessness of the driver. Lastly, I'd like to focus on something we haven't, though. It was touched on somewhat for the first time in this session, I think, but to me it's a very important issue. This legislation is intolerably wasteful of taxpayer money through the use of court time. Not only in the lower courts, in which we've had testimony here today about the inordinate amount of time that has to go into handling those cases and the confusion that's bred in the jury instructions and the fact that they're not easily settleable because the insurance carrier figures it's got a better chance at winning, but they are intolerable in terms of the waste of our appellate court time. Since the adoption of this statute, there have been 109 appellate decisions on this statute alone up to 1976, and while I can't give you an accurate figure for the last few years, I'm aware of at least three or four cases between the 77 session of the legislature and the 79 session by the Oregon Supreme Court on this issue. A knotty little problem, not of much consequence. And it seems to me that we're at the point where we should say to ourselves that that's an intolerable situation and a waste of our appellate judges' efforts. I would recommend to the committee that the statute be repealed.
Question for the witness? Representative?
Do you share the observation of the attorney that appeared this afternoon that really about the only way that you can get a judge to properly rule with you on the negligence is recklessness, show reckless driving in an automobile?
That's the standard that the Oregon Supreme Court has pretty much established in their definition. It's been so difficult to define what the concept of gross negligence meant that in order to save the statute from being unconstitutionally vague, Justice O'Connell adopted a standard of recklessness in order to give it some meaningful content to save it from being vague. And in doing so, what he did, while it might have been a notable thing in the sense of saving the statute from being unconstitutionally vague, in the process it cut out a lot of people from being able to recover because it increased the burden of the plaintiff, which I think was an unfair and an inappropriate result under those circumstances.
Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I have one.
Representative Lamar.
John, I remember, too, the study that was done, or the attempt that was done to ascertain from the states that recently had repealed comparative negligence whether or not insurance premiums had risen dramatically. And I believe that there was no conclusive evidence in some states that they had risen at all. So, I mean, I tend to be sympathetic to your argument about the uncertain effects of the get passage appeal on the premium structure. But we have wildly varying statements as to what happened to insurance premiums.
Something very, very basic is that even if it would raise premium rates, isn't that the appropriate thing to do? To take a loss where you can show somebody was careless, negligent, and say you must pay for it, even if it means. What you are in effect doing is cutting down a person's liability by saying you're not going to be responsible for losses that you negligently create. That's contrary to the traditional principle of negligence in our society. It seems to me a wholly unfair and unjust result. If we were worried about the premium losses, the thing to do is to just say it's an uninsurable matter. It can't be insured, but place the liability on the individual. But we wouldn't want to do that because then it would place the loss on the individual driver, and they wouldn't have an efficient mechanism to spread it out in. So what we've done is we've turned it around and cut back on the liability, which seems to me wholly inappropriate.
Further questions to the witness? Thank you, sir. Mrs. Thelma Asbury.
I'm new here. I've never been here before. But
yes,
I'm here.
State your name for the record.
Mrs. Thelma Asbury. And I heard you were having this meeting today, so I thought I'd like to come up and explain about the car wreck my son was in. It was 3 years ago. He was 17 years old. He was a passenger in a car driven by a boy who was 20 with another passenger. And they came to a stop down on McClay Road, which he was familiar with the road there. He's driven it many times. And he came to a stop, and the other brother told him to step on it. And he went into a 15-mile-an-hour corner, doing probably 70, sideswiped the car, jumped a ditch, and hit a big oak tree and totaled the car out. My son's back was broken in three places. Had two compressed vertebrae. And he hasn't got nothing for it. No doctor bills paid, no nothing.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
When was this accident?
3 years ago.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Asbury, have you had the case evaluated by a trial attorney?
Well, we have an attorney, but he said there's nothing they can do. There's, you know.
And was the statement that there was nothing that they could do based upon the fact that he was a guest passenger?
That mostly, and about this. He said they have to prove gross negligence. He was negligent, but not grossly negligent. And although he was cited for failure to have his car under control, it was a real rainy night. And this particular turn is down on McClay Road. It's a very sharp turn. It's posted at 15. I think they were driving a big Thunderbird, which is a pretty heavy car with a big motor in it. And it veed the motor back just like that. Just, you know, my son was in the middle, and the impact broke his back. He had three vertebrae broken, two of them were compressed. He was in a back brace for a year. No loss of time, no nothing.
Representative Smith.
I'd just like to see if did he happen to have health insurance of his own or other insurance covered any of this? Okay, thank you.
No. Did the driver of the car have any insurance?
The mother did.
The mother did.
Did she own the car?
She's been able to TIP.
The mother did.
Okay, any further questions for the witness? Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there anyone who has not signed up to testify on House Bill 2306 that would like to do so? If not, we'll close the public hearing at this time and move into work session. Mr. Strohmeyer.
Move House Bill 2306 to the full committee with the recommendations to be sent to the floor with the due-pass recommendation.
Representative Strohmeyer moves that House Bill 2306 be sent to the full committee with the due-pass recommendation. Representative Smith.
I guess I've got some perhaps collateral concerns about the bill, and maybe they don't relate to the bill and the merits of whether it should go to the full committee or not, but I'd like to raise it. Number one, based on Mr. Bessonette's testimony, I'd like to explore his concept of dealing with the comparative negligence theory and to see if that, in combination with this, is a more responsible approach. Secondly, recall my thoughts on it. Well, let's just start with that one. And that almost requires a bill for an act in another area not related to this statute.
It couldn't be done, in fact, under the related part of this bill, Mark.
But the committee, of course, has felt a need, could have a committee bill in to do just that. And since you apparently had a great deal to do with the statute before, I'd ask you whether you see the merit of doing it.
Well, I think it's
possible there's some deficiencies in the comparative negligence statute. In fact, Professor Vickery is also an expert in that area and has done a lot of writing and thinking about it. It's one of those things where you push one place and it comes out the other. It's a very complicated statute to deal with, and I'm reluctant to do that in the context of this bill. I certainly wouldn't have any objection looking at the whole comparative negligence statute the way it is to see if it's administered properly. And we have to administer that to that in conjunction with the third-party practice statutes that we have and the contribution and indemnity statutes that we have. And this is an extremely difficult area to get through. I certainly have no objection to doing it, but I would be reluctant to do it at the expense of holding up the testing of the waters on this bill this time.
I would make the point, Representative Smith, that there isn't been a law of man devised yet that doesn't have some inequity somewhere. And really, I guess the charge of this committee and the legislature is to try to reduce those inequities to the point where they're as few as possible. I see this bill, whether or not there's a redefinition of the comparative negligence law, the contribution indemnity statute, that's moving in that direction. There are going to be fewer cases of inequity in our tort laws if this passes. There may be different cases, but fewer. So I don't see that point necessarily tied to the future of this bill.
Representative Smith. One of my other concerns, I suppose, is the economic impact of this, perhaps on raising premiums. And I guess I'm a little surprised, I'll make this as a comment, that we haven't had more testimony today from other insurance carriers in the industry on what the real impact of this would be on the cost of a liability policy.
We do have a letter that's been submitted to us by Mr. Hughes, who I think has left, that indicates that at least in the case of motorcycle insurance materials, that it could have an effect. And a telegram from Progressive Casualty says that they anticipate an increase in liability insurance premiums in motorcycle cases of about 55%.
Not quite quadruple, which is what...
No, I mean, I think that the claims there are exaggerated. And I should have brought to this committee, and I'll bring to the full committee if the bill gets there. The evidence from other states which tend at least to show that the increases range from inconsequential or negligible or not even detectable to modest. And the notion that the insurance premiums are suddenly going to escalate beyond belief, I think, is simply an overstatement. And I think for the reasons that Professor Vettery has indicated to us, that there are many cases now where, in fact, you have to insure on the basis that the guest passenger will recover through some other theory. So it's not as though you're suddenly taking a total category that doesn't have to be anticipated anyway.
Well, in our PIP...
Representative Fugis?
In our PIP law... We're in a work session now.
That's correct.
In our PIP law anyway, he makes another good point. We have vitiated to some degree the concept of gross negligence. Well, I guess that's the thing. We've said we want people rewarded or somehow indemnified, at least up to that point. And so we've cut into it, at least to that degree. And I haven't seen figures either. I am concerned about the economic impact, but I sense I'm standing in the middle of a railroad track, and I'm not going to vote no to get it out of the subcommittee, but I do reserve the right to change my vote in the full committee, and I would very much appreciate seeing anything that says something about the effect to the insurance holders, even though I tend to agree also with a comment made by a professor that maybe it's the right thing to do anyway. I'm not saying I would change my mind, even if I found out it was pretty costly to me or all of us. But I would like to study that.
Okay. Representative Smith.
I recall the other collateral matter, which, again, by repealing this, maybe it is not important. Maybe someone could refresh me. Where else, if anywhere else, are we dealing with the concept of gross negligence statutorily?
Well,
what I'm driving at is I'm concerned, Mr. Chairman.
It comes up in the Good Samaritan statutes with respect to doctors rendering medical care. Interesting enough, in the ski resort bill that's up, there's a gross negligence concept that would be reinserted there. But by and large, we've been pretty successful in keeping the utilization of that concept out of our general liability law, and where it has inserted itself, it's more or less been repealed, or at least resisted. It's a very difficult concept to administer and define and refine.
Now, as a general policy matter, should that concept be before our committee in other forums, or should we discover other forums? I'd really like to see some work done to clarify that. If we have more than one test going around the state, I think we ought to try to codify the most meaningful one we can come up with.
We may lose the benefit of the 109th appellate case, but it gives the Supreme Court more work to do, but that certainly would be something to look at. Is there further discussion on the motion?
Chairman,
Representative Romine.
I didn't really speak to my motion. Let me do it briefly. I think the witnesses have spoken to it through their mouths much better than I could. I think the case has been made that it's arbitrary. I think the case has been made that it discriminates against a class of injured victims in a very arbitrary way, depending upon whether or not they've paid a dime or not for the ride, or how whether you can prove a person is a guest and when they are. I think it's been established that it's very difficult to administer, that it costs an enormous amount of court time and public time and taxpayers' time to refine it through the courts. I think it's been established that it discourages settlement of cases that should be settled in a prompt and economical manner. And I think the case has been made that it is inconsistent with both our comparative negligence statute and the personal injury benefits under the PIP plan. I just think it finally reached the time when the statute's time has come to go. And I think we ought not be the last to abolish it, but we're down to number 11, and I think that's a clear indication that we ought to be part of a national trend.
Further, Representative Cohen.
I have a plain ordinary question, and I'm sorry. Why were motorcycle exempted from PIP to begin with?
I can't answer that.
You blame the ordinary.
I just want to tell you, if you're riding a motorcycle and you've got somebody riding with you, why do you need to have that kind of liability?
I don't know, Tom.
Anyway.
Mr. Bessonette, would you like to come up?
Tom Bessonette, in answering that question directly, the legislature in whatever year PIP law was enacted felt that it would be prohibitively expensive to sell PIP insurance or force mandatorily PIP insurance on every motorcyclist because you cover the driver as well as the passenger. And they would not buy the insurance at all, liability insurance at all, because they're all dovetailed together. You must buy the liability insurance and the PIP insurance on the automobile. And therefore, in their wisdom, they excluded the motorcyclists, hoping that they would buy their own health insurance so that they would be covered for health insurance injuries. That's
why. I see. Thank you.
Further questions or comments on the motion? Representative Mason.
I think the yes passenger statute is an anachronism in the truest sense of the word. It was a bad law in 1961. It continued to be so for 18 years. And I'm quite amazed that it's taken Oregon legislature this long to get to this point. If they've been to this point before, and I hope we can go beyond just passing it out of a subcommittee.
Well, Mr. Bessonette is very effective.
I realize that, and Mr. Bessonette is a good person. But if I've seen anything that you can get a little impassioned about, it's the inequities that are created under the guest passenger statute.
Copy let's say it can be obtained for your client.
Let's be frank about it. It is an anachronism. The absurdity of some of the cases we've heard are just overwhelming. Whether they be the being picked up, be taken to a movie versus riding to the movie, the injuries that go uncompensated, it's got to stop.
Further questions, comments?
Representative
Smith.
I just recall my first jury trial in a personal injury case involving an automobile, and the matter came back for medical bills. The specials were awarded only and no general damages because the person who turned out to be the foreman of the jury didn't believe in any compensatory damages, that you sort of go through life taking your chances. I take it we have none of those on our committee this day.
Okay, the motion is by Representative Frohmeyer to send House Bill 2306 to the full committee with the two pass recommendations. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dugan?
No.
Owen?
No.
Frohmeyer?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Gardner?
Aye. Failed.
Is there further business to come before the committee?
I'll bring it to the subcommittee instead of the full committee for
adjournment. Not, this is not so limited.